friends, happy Friends of France Tuesday. I hope you're all having a good holiday season. Can you believe that we're about to enter 2026 after tomorrow? Like, what? For all those who get it, tomorrow, Wednesday, January 31st, 2025, is not only New Year's Eve, but it's also the finale of the fifth season of Stranger Things on Netflix. Ah, is anybody else a Stranger Things fan? This is such a big moment for me because this show is so nostalgic. The first episode of Stranger Things, Season 1, aired on July 15th, 2016. Almost 10 years ago. I remember exactly when the show first came out because it was the summer right before I started my nursing school program, aka before the start of PTSD. This show was such a safe space for me then, despite how eerie and malevolent the plotline is. Growing up, I was such a huge fan of magical and science fiction shows and movies, like Harry Potter, The Lord of the Rings, Twilight, Percy Jackson, Divergent, and Stranger Things kind of falls in that concept, so I love the show and have followed it since. It's crazy to think also that it's been 10 years since I first started my healthcare journey. I was in nursing school, then I became a medical assistant in a cardiology practice, where I would then become a cardiac RN several years later after graduation. Went on to the hospital as a bedside nurse in the cardiac surgery step-down unit, then back to the cardiology practice as an interventional cardiology post-anesthesia nurse. Then now, I'm at another practice specializing in adult congenital heart disease and other complex cases like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and lipidology. Yes, if you haven't noticed, there's only one thing I know how to do. Cardiology. If it ain't about a heart, please don't ask me about it. You know, I get random texts from friends who seek medical advice, as one does to their healthcare worker friends, and ask me about their symptoms, and I'm always like, oh, a headache? Oh, a stomach ache? Oh, back pain? Not chest pain? Not palpitations? Yeah, please don't ask me. Go to the emergency room. It's actually so interesting how cardiology is such a full circle for me. Having worked in the cardiology field now for 10 years since college, it took me a moment to realize that I was actually once a cardiac patient myself. In April 2016, just a few months before Stranger Things aired, I actually suffered from severe palpitations and fast heart rate. So bad that I had to go through a non-surgical procedure called a cardiac ablation, where the cardiologist basically burns the part of the heart that is causing the extra or outlier heartbeats to hopefully restore that normal sinus rhythm. It's crazy to think that for the past 10 years, I have been the nurse who is taking care of patients who are experiencing what I once did. What an honor. And in today's episode, we talk exactly about that. My favorite topic right after skincare. The heart. In the second season of our podcast, we spoke to two other cardiac experts, Dr. Ali Hader, a board-certified interventional cardiologist, where we spoke more about cath procedures, and my friend Danielle Levesque, a cardiothoracic surgery ICU nurse practitioner who talked about the nursing side of cardiac care. Today, we speak more about general heart health and some of the most feared words in the world, heart attack, chest pain, and cholesterol buildup. I'm so honored to have my dear friend, Dr. Dialis Tétier, to speak to us today all about the heart. Dr. Dialis is a board-certified cardiologist and assistant professor of clinical medicine, focusing on hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and sports cardiology here in New York City. He serves as an assistant professor of clinical medicine and principal investigator of clinical studies at Weill Cornell Medical College, and she's the director of the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy program in the Division of Cardiology at New York Presbyterian Hospital. An icon. Okay, let's have a heart-to-heart talk. Literally. Sometimes, it's not time that heals all wounds, but flowers steeped gently into a cup of tea. Inspired by founder Lisa Lee's own healing journey from thyroid disease and burnout, the Chi is a wellness brand based in New York City on a mission to help people feel more joy, calm, and connection through the power and beauty of flowering teas. The Chi was born from the discovery of rare, single-origin whole flower teas rooted in centuries-old Eastern rituals. Each bloom is hand-picked at peak vitality by small family-owned farms across Asia to offer a grounding, sensorial experience that reconnects you to yourself, one cup at a time. Choose from the Shangri-La Rose, Blue Lotus, and the Royal Chrysanthemum and get 15% off at the-chi.com. That's the-chi.com with the code FRANZ. That's FRANZ. One-time use and cannot be combined with other codes. drink flowers, feel alive.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Friends of France podcast. Today, I am so excited to have this very special person on, our expert guest for today. You know, she's a cardiologist, the director of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, that's a mouthful, program at Weill Cornell Medicine. She's a published poet, a very successful marathon runner. In the part-time, she paints in Central Park. And she's such a good friend.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I have to say, it started off so accurate. And then the more you spoke, I was like, I don't know that applies to me. But it is a real pleasure to be here and to talk to you today.
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, I've been working in cardiology since early college. You know, I started as a medical assistant in an interventional cardiology place. And then after nursing school, went to inpatient. And then now we're together at work. So I feel like the heart is the only organ I know and can talk about. Sometimes, you know, with healthcare providers or healthcare workers, your friends texts you 11 p.m. He's like, what's wrong with me? And I'm like, that's not the heart. I don't know. But here we're in the presence of an expert. But I feel like every expert and every accomplished persona has a background story. So I wanted to know, what's your background and what's your journey that led you to your current endeavors today?
Yeah. So my name is Dialis Diatir. I'm a cardiologist with a special focus on hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, as well as just seeing patients with a whole scope of cardiac disease. My journey probably started from a young age. I grew up in a culture where, you know, family and community health were always valued. And so the idea of giving back to community through medicine seemed like an obvious interest of mine. My education and training, I became fascinated with the heart, how such a small organ has such a profound role in sustaining life. And thankfully, my professional path has really allowed me to blend clinical care, research, and patient advocacy. And I'm also able to do that through a program that I direct at the moment to help improving patient outcomes with complex heart disease.
Yeah, I love that. You were talking about how the heart truly is such a small organ, but such a huge role in sustaining life. Now, there is a known statement that says the heart is life. Can you explain to the general public how the heart actually sustains life? What does the heart actually do?
The heart truly is life because it serves both as a pump and an electrical engine. So mechanically, it pushes blood through the vessels to deliver oxygen and nutrients to every single cell. And electrically, it generates signals that keep the pump coordinated and steady, beat after beat, over 100,000 times a day. And without both systems working in harmony, you just can't sustain life. So, you know, truly the heart is life.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, right? One could never think that there's an electrical of sorts system inside their body that's basically allowing them to live every single second. And even the mechanical aspect that you were mentioning of those nutrients. I think when I was, in elementary school, the first time I heard of the heart, obviously I knew I had one, but to actually kind of first hear what it does, I was like, really? It's the one pushing nutrients to the rest of my body?
Right, because even when we think about the electrical function, we say it and it's so nonchalant, or electrical system. But I guess you're right, for the general person, hearing that the heart works through electrical systems, I think it does maybe surprise some people.
It's so fascinating indeed. You know, I wanted to focus a little bit more on that mechanical aspect that you were talking about, that pushing of nutrients. But I feel like as with anything in the body, it's not perfect, right? Unfortunately. And sometimes things go awry and things go wrong, specifically within this mechanical plumbing aspect of the heart, right? You know, the WHO in 2023, they gave us a statistic that said atherosclerotic heart disease, or coronary artery disease, or as we know as CAD, remains the leading cause of death globally, responsible for an estimated 9 million deaths per year. And around 1 in 3 deaths worldwide are due to cardiovascular disease with atherosclerosis as the underlying cause in most cases. I guess we have some listeners to this podcast right now. What does that mean? And what is coronary artery disease? What is CAD and how does it cause lives?
It's a great question. You know, coronary artery disease, it has a number of different names. You may have heard of it as atherosclerotic heart disease. It happens when cholesterol and plaque build up in the arteries that feed the heart muscles. And so these arteries are like plumbing pipes. If they do get clogged, the heart doesn't get enough blood or oxygen. And over time, this narrowing or sudden blockage will lead to chest pain, heart attacks, heart failure, which is weakening of the heart muscle. And yeah, as you mentioned, unfortunately, it does remain the number one cause of death worldwide. And it's something that I often tell my patients, like they'll come to see me, let's say often for something else. And then I look at their history and it's like, well, I know that's not the reason you came, but like, by the way, when we think about every single person, the most common cause, men and women, of morbidity and mortality is cardiovascular disease. And so it's a really good opportunity to think about those, you know, risk factors and intervening, because no one's immune to it.
I love that point so much. And specifically about, I guess, when you were mentioning chest pain, I think having watched so many movies throughout the year, even before entering healthcare, I think there's top three health events that they usually show in movies, right? That gives the most drama. It's either a diagnosis of cancer or someone having a stroke. And definitely you'll see probably a character in a movie clenching their chest and be like, I think I'm having a heart attack.
Yeah.
Exactly. What is a heart attack? How does it happen? I mean, obviously it's scary, especially outside of our field. I can't imagine being, you know, just someone walking in the streets and maybe your loved one or even a random person in the street suddenly falls down to the ground with chest pain. What is a heart attack? How does it happen? And I guess, how can one prevent it?
Yeah, it's a good question, because we were just saying arteries can become clogged off, and that can either happen gradually, and so you'll end up with some chest pain that worsens over time. Hopefully you get seen by a cardiologist, evaluated, and you can kind of stop it through risk factor modification. And a heart attack is unfortunately when an artery just very suddenly closes off completely. And that's usually because of plaque, which was minimal, let's say, you know, 20%, 30% plaque, it suddenly ruptures. When you rupture plaque, similar to like when you cut yourself, if there's a cut in the plaque or cut on your skin, a blood clot forms on top of it. And so when you have plaque rupture, a blood clot forms on top, and that very suddenly just clogs off the whole vessel. And so part of the heart muscle will die if you don't get seen by a doctor very quickly and get that blood vessels open. And so it's important to understand that it's especially heart attacks that we're very concerned about, because if you have slow progression of coronary disease, your heart can sometimes get some compensatory vasculature that even grows to help that area of muscle that's not being well fed. But when you very suddenly block off a blood vessel, that's when you're in trouble.
Yeah, it's so harrowing to think about, just something suddenly happening. But I guess, like you said, there's a lot of that comes into play, especially not only in the body, but the heart in itself. I mean, plaque formation itself, it's not an immediate thing, right? It's like probably an elapsed time of certain risk factors that's kind of like a multifactorial aspect. So when it comes to heart attack in itself, or even CAD in general, what are the risk factors that we know of, things that we probably can change, that alter in our lives, or some that unfortunately sometimes we can't?
No, that's a great question. So, you know, there are thankfully a lot of things that are risk factors that we can change. And so that includes things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, smoking, obesity, poor diet, lack of exercise. So really, that's where prevention really comes in. And I have to say, on the topic of high blood pressure, I remember when I was studying for my cardiology boards, there was a question on the boards that asked, this was like a practice, you know, question series I was doing. And so one of them was, what percentage of the US population has normal blood pressure, like well controlled? And so I remember the options, it was something like, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80. And I remember looking at the options, and I was like, there's definitely no way it's 50 or 60. We're not like amazing, so maybe it's 70%. And I remember being so shocked that the answer was literally 50%. And so that's 50% of people, you know, we don't know this in that data, how many of them are seeing doctors regularly or whatnot, but I bet you vast majority were probably making contact with a health professional, hopefully at least once a year. And so we'll often like see some high blood pressure. You're like, oh, but you know, it's like close enough. And, you know, Miss Smith doesn't want to increase her meds, so we'll leave it alone, or white coat hypertension or whatnot. But the reality is we're way under treating. And that's just the hypertension statistics. And then, as you mentioned, there's some things that we can't quite control. And that's, you know, age. As you get older, the risk increases, family history and genetics. When you think about the whole list, though, there's a ton of preventative things you can do.
Imagine if skincare could do more, but with less. Meet Remsen, a New York brand made in South Korea, where world-leading innovation meets the no-nonsense energy of New York City. Their essential duo keeps it effective and efficient with high-quality ingredients. Their Gentle Greens Cleanser, featuring green tea, centella, and aloe, cleanses without drying. And the multitasking peptide moisturizer combines bakuchiol, ceramides, and a clinically proven dose of peptides in a single lightweight step to hydrate, strengthen the skin barrier, and help prevent visible signs of aging. Both are safe for sensitive and acne-prone skin types, vegan, cruelty-free, and beautifully packaged with sustainable materials, making the set a great gift. You can get 20% off your first purchase on remsenskincare.com. That's remsenskincare.com with the code FRANZ. That's FRANZ. One-time use and cannot be combined with other codes. Get maximal results with minimal steps. How do you know when something actually tastes good to an Asian person? When they say, it's not too sweet. And that's precisely what Wild Mannered set out to do. Founded by two childhood best friends who were tired of drinks that were too sweet, too artificial, and left them with worse hangovers, Wild Mannered is an Asian American founded brand focused on bridging people together with all natural, shareable soju cocktails. With flavors like strawberry basil, cucumber lime mint, and pineapple ginger, every sip is made with real fruits and botanicals and perfectly balanced at a lighter 13% ABV. Refreshing, smooth, and never too sweet. Get 10% off your first order with code FRANZ, that's FRANZ, at drinkwildmannered.com or hit the store locator to find them in stores across New York City. Make your next get-together a little more wild-mannered.
There's one specific thing that I wanted to talk about because, one, I've been seeing our patients actually talk about it more or inquire about it. I feel like they don't really have a general sense of what it is, but they saw it on the internet. I think there was this Reddit thread that I stumbled upon, or maybe even like viral Facebook posts, and everyone was clamoring about this in the comments. They're like, what is lipoprotein A? I think it's this new buzzword that a lot of social media accounts have been telling people to ask your doctor about this test. Ask your doctor to get
this
test.
And I get so excited when a patient comes in and they kind of already know. Because also then you look a little impressive because when you start mentioning it, they're like, that's what I was going to say. So I do think people are a lot more aware, which is awesome. For protein A, it's a cholesterol particle that is inherited genetically. And unlike LDL cholesterol, which is influenced by diet and lifestyle, LPA is just something you're essentially kind of born with. And so high levels do increase the risk of heart disease and stroke, independent of what your LDL is. So in other words, even if your other cholesterol numbers look good, an elevation in lipoprotein A does result in a higher risk of coronary disease. And that's why, to your point, I think there's been so much attention on testing it, because it really adds another layer of understanding someone's risk profile, especially if you're coming in with a patient who has a family history of what we call premature early coronary disease. You really got to do everything you can to identify if there is something like a lipoprotein A elevation. Not necessarily that you're going to give a medicine that lowers LPA, but then what it tells you is you better do a really good job controlling every other risk factor, because there is that independent risk.
Yeah, and it comes to risk markers as well. I wanted to ask, I've been also hearing people clamoring about this online. Obviously, we see it every day at work, but about the calcium score.
Yeah.
Can you explain to people what calcium score is and why should someone be wary of it or should be interested in it?
Yeah. So calcium score testing is essentially a CT scan of the heart, relatively low radiation, no contrast. And what it does is it looks at your coronary arteries. It can't see the plaque itself because plaque, when it first deposits, so in other words, that cholesterol deposit, it's soft and it's difficult to see through a CT scan. Because CT is really great for like bone, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so though you cannot see the soft plaque, plaque is often calcified. And so calcium deposits on top of that plaque. And so when you're getting a coronary calcium score, you're basically saying, do you have coronary calcifications, which is synonymous to underlying coronary disease? Super helpful, because if you're someone with elevated cholesterol and you're on the fence, like, gosh, I really don't want to start a medicine. Maybe you've heard, you know, scary things from your friends or something. And so if you do have coronary calcifications, I often find it is the easiest decision maker for patients. Because if you tell them you already have disease, by the way, they're much, much more likely to start the medicine. And as a patient, I think if your cholesterol is elevated, certainly a really good test to get. Fortunately, it seems that insurance doesn't like to prevent. And so because it's to prevent heart attacks, it's pretty much universally not covered by insurance. But thankfully, because it's such a great test, most imaging centers don't charge too much for it, like $100, $150. So definitely a great idea for folks.
I feel so grateful that we also live in a generation where medical technology and science has introduced us to many risk stratification measures
100%.
That I'm sure decades ago. People just do not know and wait for, you know, those years of calcified plaque to just do their mortality responsibilities, unfortunately. Right. But I think also years ago as well, the landscape of therapeutic drugs and medications is not the same as it was now, obviously. Mm-hmm. And we have a great big help of our friends, the statins, which I didn't realize that, as I find in the discourses online, is actually a very controversial and a very feared base of medications, which I was so surprised about. I see comments of, and it's probably not in a general sense. I feel like it's just select groups or communities of people, but they'll always link it to the great big Lipitor and the big pharma. But we've seen great effects in our patients when it comes to the reduction of their LDL or the quote-unquote bad cholesterol. But curious, how do statins work? Any words of reassurance for those who may fear or be wary of statins? And I guess as a whole, do we have any data on how efficacious statins actually are in preventing cardiac events and disease?
No, that's a great question. Statins lower cholesterol by blocking the liver's production of it, especially LDL, which is often named bad cholesterol. And they're among the most studied drugs in medicine, with decades of data showing that they do reduce heart attacks, strokes, and death. But your point's well taken. You know, I do think a lot of people do worry about side effects, but the vast majority of folks, you know, at the end of the day, do tolerate them very well. There are certain things that make you a little more likely to develop side effects. So the higher the dose, that's a higher risk side effect. The older you are, Asian ethnicities. So of the folks who tend to have side effects, a little bit higher in those cohorts of patients. But the way that I would think about it, Christian, is if you have really high cholesterol, it should almost be in your mind a non-option to leave it alone. So then if you are really concerned about statins, well, first of all, sure, ask for this additional risk stratification testing, because then it might, in your mind, make the benefit and risk ratio much better. And then also ask about other options. You know, I do think the reality is sometimes we get into issues with insurance, but there are other drugs you can use to lower the risk of stroke and heart attacks. That's the main thing that I would say to leave with folks is you're allowed to not want the medicine, but you'd be doing yourself a disservice living with really high cholesterol. And so think about maybe additional testing to make the decision easier, and or think about alternatives.
Yeah, I love that. And I feel like also when it comes to medications, even outside of our field of cardiology, there's always, I think, an offer from the patient of like, oh, what if I modify this aspect of my life first? And then if it doesn't work, then we can try the medication, which I think is very reasonable, right? And
100%. I think the only times where I'd really push back is like we did the risk stratification and everything is insane. Their LDL is insanely high. Like they have really bad family history. And I'll say, listen, at the end of the day, your body, like you make the decision you're comfortable with, but I have to tell you, I like really urge you to consider sooner rather than later. Thankfully, I'd say a minority of patients are that cohort. So most of the time, okay, you do some risk stratification. Maybe some of it's abnormal, some of it's normal. They have a strong preference. Great. So then like if you can do it naturally, I don't want to give you a drug. But then the way that what I tell people is like, you've got to really put it in your calendar. You're scheduling another visit in 3 to 6 months. Hold yourself accountable. Because I think more often than not, we find this thing of like, you know, just work on lifestyle. And then they see like their PCP a year later, and then it's still kind of elevated. And it's like, I work your own lifestyle. And then you don't realize you've been saying that for like 6 years. Like you should probably at that point consider something more.
Yeah. And I think what's also great about this risk stratification tools is that they further individualize, I guess, our approach to treatment 100%. For the patient, right? Like everyone's calcium score will be different in combination of their LDL and in combination of their ASCVD, the risk, and combination with their family history. So it's just great how technology has science has brought us to a landscape and a terrain where we can really individualize therapy. And I guess patients also want their care individualized, right? They don't want to be treated in a one-size-fits-all or one-shoebox kind of situation, which is obviously so important. And I think 100%. What's also very variable across our patients, and something that probably we don't even talk much about, is when it comes to diet and sometimes the cultural implications when it comes to someone's diet, right?
Oh, such a good point. Yeah, I don't even think about that enough. You're right.
Yeah. So I guess in general sense, what role does diet have in heart health in general? And specifically when it comes to preventing coronary atherosclerosis. I think even since nursing school, we hear of the heart healthy diet.
Yes.
What exactly is it? And also, actually, our good friend Dr. Tim was our guest last week, our last episode. And we did talk about
diet. I went to residency with Dr. Tim.
There we go. What a small world. We're all friends of friends.
Yes, we are.
And we talked about diet in the context of more of the oncological aspect. How about in coronary health? What does diet have to do with this?
I mean, diet is absolutely fundamental. A heart-healthy diet, which is one that is rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, lean proteins. And so that's things like fish and legumes. And really, as much as you can, low in processed foods and red meat and added sugar. If you can do that alone and make those small changes, you're kind of already 80% there. If people want particular diets that have the most data, certainly the Mediterranean diet has the best data for reducing cardiovascular risk. There's something called the DASH diet, which is especially helpful in controlling blood pressure. But yeah, like to your point, what we eat every day literally shapes the health of our arteries. But your point's really well taken. If you're part of a culture that is very reliant on red meat, it's more challenging. Like, I think even when I think about my mom's cooking, we don't eat unhealthy, but like when she makes a meal, it's like, you know what? I'm going to eat it. Like, it's fine. Yeah. But I think you have to kind of pick and choose, and it's hard to walk away from it altogether. But the more you can try to reduce it, the better, and be a little more selective.
Yeah. I'm curious, what does a cardiologist's diet looks like?
Oh my God. I'm a mess. So I go through very different phases. I just came out of a vegan phase. So that was fun. To be fair, actually, the vegan diets have been shown to be really, really great at lowering cholesterol, but I don't think it's anything magical. I think it's just you're not eating animal products, which tend to be a little higher in fat and certainly no red meat. So that was it at some point. But I think overall, I seldom eat red meat. So if my mom is in town and she's cooking, all bets are off.
Heck yeah.
It's a restaurant that I absolutely love. Like I'll go to L'Entrecote and I'm going to have the steak there. But yeah, I'll do it once every few months. So I think on average throughout the week, I usually don't have meat. Throughout the month, maybe like twice, 2 to 3 times max, I'll have meat. And it'll usually be when I'm eating out somewhere and I just know they have the best something dish.
Yeah.
But yeah, otherwise, I do really try to stick to mostly fruits, vegetables. I'll do a lot of salads during the day. I don't really do much of any processed foods, except when I'm having a nervous breakdown, Toblerone. Sorry. I think that's like my weakness. But you know, frankly, that's the reality. Like, I'm conscious of the fact that you can't stick to it 100%. But the reality is a lot of people are sticking to it like 40%. And if you can just make it 70, 60%, whatever is the most reasonable for you, the more the better.
Yeah. Not me working from home, answering cholesterol questions from patients
while
with a cupcake in my hand.
So you got to practice what you preach. But I do think, you know, thankfully, we practice it like 80, 90% of the time.
Yeah, I love that. No, now that we've covered about diet, I think also an important thing is the fact that even a form of exercise is called cardio, right? How important is physical activity when it comes to heart?
I mean, it's so important. We know that physical activity has massive benefits. And, you know, some of them are intuitive, right? Like the more you walk or do some form of exercise, the less likely you are to be overweight. Probably the more likely you are to like watch what you eat because you're working hard, you're exercising. Exercising even for 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise. So that's like speed walking, Zumba classes. It doesn't have to be insane. But if you do 150 minutes a week, that's been shown to have improvement in cardiovascular outcomes. And so it's super, super important. And I think if you could make it a habit of your day, all the better.
We long for what's natural, yet often hide it with layers. And today's soap market is no different, crowded with products that are harsh and overly processed. Born in Seoul, South Korea, Chai Minu was made to bring things back to something simpler, something intentional. Each handcrafted bar of soap is cold processed in small batches, using only natural oils and botanical powders. It is then cured and air dried for over 1,000 hours, letting the bar harden naturally for a gentler feel and a longer life. It all began with a mother searching for relief for her son's sensitive skin and her refusal to settle for harsh liquid soaps or quick-made bars. Let your skin experience the byproduct of patience, simplicity, and a mother's love. For 15% off at shybinu.com. That's shybinu.com with the code FRANZ. That's FRANZ. What if your night out could come with a smarter tomorrow? Meet Dayguard, a Korean-inspired functional jelly stick designed to support liver health, hydration, gut balance, and vitamin replenishment when drinking alcohol. With science-backed ingredients like DHM, L-cysteine, prickly pear extract, L-arginine, and B vitamins, each convenient and delicious stick helps your body break down alcohol and reduce next-day sluggishness. Just take one stick before your first drink of the night and support your body's natural recovery so you can wake up refreshed. Get 10% off your first purchase at daygard.com, that's daygurd.com, with the code FRANZ, that's FRANZ. One-time use and cannot be combined with other codes.
A wide group of our patients, or even in the general public, I think tries to kind of mix these more quote-unquote conservative and holistic approaches to heart health, or what they think is heart health, with more of evidence-based and scientific published approach to heart health when it comes to, like, let's say, like statins or getting those exams and more of a very rigid diet or whatnot. And then there's those who try to message us and be like, oh, instead of taking statins, or, you know, I eat a lot of butter, but I'm also taking the supplements that
hopefully...
Oh, so hopefully
it's like canceled out a little bit.
It cancels out the, you know, the butter, the red meat that I ate. Yeah. Or maybe I don't have to take statins because I'm taking these medications. You know, a 2015 survey by National Consumer and Medication Experience and Pharmacist Role states that about 35% of U.S. adults report using herbal medicines, and usage rise to 43% among those diagnosed with heart disease, compared to 35% with that, which is actually a lot. Especially in our practice, right? We often receive messages from patients along the lines of, like I said, I'm wondering if it's safe for me to take the supplement to lower my cholesterol, blood pressure, instead of this ACE inhibitor or instead of a statin. Yeah. Based on all the messages and the calls you receive, or even during visits, what are the usual herbs and supplements that patients ask you about, and what do they promise to do?
It's a good question. You know, I don't know if I'm a little lucky, so I feel like I don't get a ton of, I want to take like the supplement question. I think the thing I get more often is, you know, I don't want to necessarily be on a statin. What I'll find sometimes, and you know what I think it is, patients are more comfortable sending messages maybe about these like alternative therapies than maybe they are saying it in person. Because when I get the sense that they really don't want a like pharmacotherapy, you know, one approach as the provider is just to be like, okay, well, you know, patient declined, and kind of the end there. What I'll say in general is, you know, most supplements, most of these herbal meds, frankly, they don't have a lot of data, whether it's safety data or efficacy data. So I think generally speaking, no matter what the thing is that you're wondering about, chances are the data is not there. So it's very tough for us to say, well, yes, it's definitely safe, or yes, it could help. There's like a few exceptions. So usually when I get a sense that they really don't want pharmacotherapy, I might say like, okay, well, listen, at the very least, like maybe try some red yeast rice extract. Like that has some data in terms of lowering cholesterol a little bit. But the reality is I'll probably only say that to someone with maybe mild to moderate elevations, low risk profile, who just don't want to do anything. Then it's like, okay, I don't feel strong enough to push you to really consider a pharmacotherapy. But then at the very least, a lot of counseling on lifestyle modifications and even considering something like red yeast rice. There is rarely a little bit of data for some of these supplements, but the issue is a lot of them are just not in evidence base.
I'm curious about what we've been hearing for years, omega-3. What actually is their efficacy profile when it comes to heart health as a whole?
Oh yeah, that's a good point. Omega-3 is one of those like rare things that has been studied quite a bit. So omega-3 fatty acids have been studied extensively for heart health, though the results do depend pretty heavily on the type of omega-3 and the dose. So initially, some of the early data on low-dose fish oil supplements didn't really show a significant reduction in, you know, major cardiovascular events. Since then, there was like one big trial that came out called Reduce It, and it showed that high dose omega-3 fatty acid supplements, especially in folks with elevated triglycerides who are on statins, there was a 25% relative reduction in cardiovascular events and a 20% reduction in cardiovascular death. So certainly there are some benefits to something like that as well. So thank you for bringing that up. In addition to the red yeast rice, that's probably the other thing, maybe the only two things off the top of my head that it does have some data for.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I realize that outside of our world here in the United States, there's a whole world of medicine in other pockets. A whole world of herbal stuff. And pockets of different countries have different approaches, obviously, to heart health and health in general, especially when it comes to, let's say, the big country of China, right? With like practices and I guess supplements and herbs rooted in thousands and thousands of years that are not tested, that's not placed in clinical trials, but have this very adamant statement or standpoint of, it works for us. And I guess we see a lot of those patients who I guess probably are outliers, where they probably don't follow anything that we say. They're kind of in great shape. And
they're like going against all the guidelines. I know, it's so true. Like, you do see this on occasion where you're just kind of like, I don't get it. How are you 82 and still haven't had a heart attack? What I'll tell you is, you know, the reality is they're more of the exception than the rule. And that's where I think probably genetics plays a bigger role than we realize. So that in spite of all those different uncontrolled risk factors, some patients do well. And then you have some folks with mild uncontrolled risk factors who do quite poorly. So I think there is more than we know about that individual risk, but I would consider those folks a little more of the outliers than the rule.
Yeah. That being said, though, do you think there's a possibility or there is worth in being able to mix more traditional heart health driven practices and beliefs into our current world of
more evidence-based data? I think it's definitely something we should probably do better in. I think the difficulty is a lot of the stuff, like even for us, right? Maybe you're a little more familiar, but if someone comes to me with a herb I've never heard of from somewhere, you know, in the, I don't know, Central Asia or something, I'm going to have a really tough time saying, like give it a shot. Because we just don't have the data. I think at the end of the day, as an individual patient, you have to understand their risks and benefits to any decision. And so all that we can do is hope that in the future, there is actually going to be some more data on some of these alternative therapies. But that without that data, we probably are doing a disservice to patients by just leaving it completely unchecked. And at the end of the day, you know, it's the patient's decision to make the decision. I think I said decision twice, but that's okay. But what our job is to really educate them and just be honest as well. Like, hey, listen, we don't have the data for this. It might be helpful. It might actually be harmful. So I can't really advise you. But you know what? You have these like four unbelievably uncontrolled risk factors. I don't think it's worth the risk of not taking a medicine and trying a herbal supplement. They still refuse. Listen, all you can do is counsel versus mild elevation, really adamant, doesn't want to be on a medicine, doesn't really have any of those additional risk factors. Okay, I understand that you don't really want the pharmacotherapy. You're not a very high risk patient, so it's reasonable to focus on lifestyle. I wouldn't personally advise you to take certain supplements that I have no data on because we just don't know if it's helpful or harmful, and just leave it at that. And at the end of the day, we all have to make decisions that we feel comfortable with.
Yeah, I love that so much. And, you know, we talked a lot about definitely the heart and its inner workings. And thank you so much for you're bringing your expertise on to talk more about it. You know, we talked about the mechanical aspect and more about coronary artery disease and lipoprotein A and the big great statins and diet and more of this herb-based supplements. And wrapped it all together really places the field of cardiology as such a complex field where it's not a one size fit all. And definitely it's kind of like bewildering to think about and just crazy to think about that all of our beating hearts, right? Like every second, it's like being taken care of autonomously that we don't even think about, right? It's such a beautiful thing to think about. And I think that's the beauty of cardiovascular medicine as well. I guess as a cardiologist, what is your hope for the future of cardiovascular medicine and I guess its service to the human health?
I think in an ideal world, we do so good with prevention that really no one has, especially atherosclerotic coronary disease. And so really my big hope for the future of cardiovascular medicine is that we continue to move towards prevention, identify risks earlier, personalized therapy, as you've already mentioned before, and really empowering patients to take charge of their health, whether that means being really on top of your lifestyle modifications, considering a medication. And equally, I hope that we can advance equity in care so that that access to the cutting edge treatment or prevention isn't really determined by where someone lives, or their background, their financial situation. Because even when you think about calcium scores, how unfortunate is it that truly universally it's not insurance covered? And so some patients will hear 150 and it's like, oh, piece of cake. And other folks just can't afford it. And so I think changing it so that prevention really is within reach of every person is really probably my biggest goal for the future. I wouldn't mind being put out of a job. No one should have heart disease.
Yeah, I love that. And as a last question, we've reached the end. It's kind of like a more fun question that I want you to think about. You know, the American Heart Association puts out these posts every day of, oh, here's a new song that you could do CPR to because it matches the beat of the heart that you need to allow for return of spontaneous circulation. If there was a song in this world that it doesn't matter what beat it is, we're talking about an imaginary world where where it doesn't have to match the 100, 120 beats per minute, what song would you want to be the gold standard song to do a CPR to?
No, I thought you were going to say, which song can you actually do it to? And all the first thing that came to my mind was Staying Alive. That's like one of the ones that took my mind as the song. And now I might have to like pull up my Spotify to see what do I love recently. I mean, the reality is also some of these aren't the best sounding names. So I feel like it would be embarrassing to say, oh, this is a safe one. Meet This Physician. I love that song. Very calming. I feel like if you're doing CPR, you don't want like, woof, woof, woof. So this is like calm. And as the patient, when you come to and your heart is back, Tweet This Physician.
There we go. We love it. Dr. Diala, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your knowledge and your experience. This was so fun. And hopefully our audience learned a lot today about their heart. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for having me. And thank you all for listening. And I was going to say reach out, but I guess you can. You can reach out to Christian and I guess not the friends of friends, but you can reach
and
out.
And listen to Sweet Disposition.
Yes, that's the other takeaway. Listen to Sweet Disposition. And there's a great remix by The Temper Trap.
There we go. Yay, thank you.
All right, guys, have a good day.